This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter on this edition of Bloomberg Best for Thursday, November 21st, 2019.
We bring you interviews from the New Economy Forum, featuring leaders from the political, finance, and corporate worlds.
Participants cover global governance, trade, technology, urbanization, climate, and much more.
I worry that some of those changes will be irreversible.
I think there's a good chance that we'll see some progress on the trade discussions.
I think protecting the independence of the Federal Reserve is of utmost importance.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
The New Economy Forum is a community of global leaders engaging with the world's most significant changes and challenges. The event is held in Beijing, China.
And June, among the speakers is Gary Cohn, who left the Trump White House in the spring of 2018. And many of the issues he faced are still there, unresolved, including a China trade deal. And he spoke with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix.
Well, first of all, I think we're having a trade skirmish. I think the two sides have some disagreements on trade. But if you look at what's going on, the two countries are functioning. There's a lot of trade still going back and forth. The United States is receiving the goods from China that we need to have a fully functioning economy, and our economy is functioning well. I hope that we get a phase one deal done, and I think it's in everyone's best interest to get a phase one deal done.
Okay, but supply chains have moved, have they not? From China, they're going elsewhere.
That's a natural business cycle, and I think that makes sense, that supply chains have moved. Maybe companies got too concentrated in one market, and maybe we're seeing more global diversification of supply chains, which in the end probably is a good thing for companies to be more diversified about where they get their products and where they get their supply of goods.
Okay, but if you have this skirmish staying and lasting for 5 years, 10 years, that must hurt the world economy.
No one wins. I'm not saying this is a good thing. Don't interpret this as a good thing. What I'm trying to say is everyone talks about how dramatic this whole trade confrontation is. It's having impact. But whenever you have impact and countries are disagreeing in some fashion, markets make up their own mind what they need to do. Markets have very quickly made up their mind. Companies have made up their mind. Look, we need to diversify our supply chain. We cannot be as dominant and dependent on one country or one supplier as we were in the past. And we've got to create more diversity in the system, which net-net is a good thing for the system. Yes, it's having some economic consequences, but it's not the only thing going on in the economy.
Okay, you've worked for President Trump. How does he view China? Is this a supremacy 10-year trade confrontation, or is this actually he wants a deal and he wants it fast if the Chinese play by the book he wants?
I think Donald Trump's more interested in getting it right in the long term. That said, and this is an important that said, he understands how important it is to get the farmers back to work in the United States. We have a big agricultural economy in the center of the United States. Our farmers need to be exporting farm products. And our farmers have gone through a very tough cycle here, losing export share to China. Our farmers need to get that back, and they need to get that back by next summer. So getting a phase one deal done would allow farmers to get back into the growing cycle, would allow farmers to become a major exporter back to China. The Chinese need to import food. So the question is, who are they going to import it from? And I think importing it from the United States is very important. So I think the president understands that it's a short-term phase one fix. Right. Getting our farmers back into the cycle of selling to China is important for the short term.
Okay, but phase one is what? Status quo?
Phase one is much more increased farm exports from where we are now, back to where we were before and even back to a higher level. In the end, President Trump cares about protecting U.S. intellectual property. He cares about protecting copyrights. He cares about market access for U.S. companies, which makes a lot of sense. You think of the United States as 350 million consumers, China 1.4 billion consumers. Wouldn't you want to, as President of the United States, open up a market to 1.4 billion consumers if you're a U.S. company? Of course you want to open up that market to the U.S. companies. So he's trying to make sure that we have a level playing field where U.S. companies can access the Chinese market, just as the Chinese have accessed the U.S. market.
But chief executives around the world, given they have little visibility, are not investing in their markets. And it could be a French chief executive, it could be a chief executive in Ohio, it could be a chief executive in Germany. That must be a negative.
So I think there's a bunch of negatives going on the investment cycle. And I'll be the first to tell you that when you're looking at CapEx and you're looking at investment in the U.S., when you look at CapEx, the first thing you're going to look at is building factories, building buildings. You're going to buy steel, you're going to buy aluminum. They were the first two things tariff. I thought that that was not the right decision. I would have never tariffed input products. It's different to tariff final goods and services than it is to tariff input products that go into something that you're going to build that creates jobs. So the cost of steel and aluminum going up in the United States takes away the competitive advantage that we gave them in lowering corporate taxes. But remember, we lowered corporate taxes to compete with the rest of the world. We lowered them to their rate. But then we made the cost of steel and aluminum higher, so it then disincentivize people from opening plants in the United States. Then layer on top of that the geopolitical situation we have in the United States right now, and it's a very tough environment.
That was former NEC Director Gary Cohn.
Coming up, we continue our coverage and hear from David Solomon, the Chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs Group. This is Bloomberg.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, this is Bloomberg Best.
And let's get back to our coverage, shall we, of the Bloomberg New Economy Forum in Beijing. Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix spoke exclusively with Goldman Sachs CEO David Solomon about the bank's next move.
We're building a digital bank that's primarily, digital consumer bank that's primarily at the moment focused on the United States. We have taken some deposits in the UK, but at the moment we're primarily focused in the United States. And we're quite excited about the progress we've made. Over the course of the last 3 years, we've built a digital consumer platform that has $55 billion of deposits, has 4 to 5 million customers, has about $7 billion of loans. We've built a credit card platform with Apple that we're quite excited about and also allows us to partner with others in the future. And so we think we have a very interesting, disruptive platform that allows us to help consumers with their financial needs in a digital format with more transparency, more information, less friction. And we're excited about what we think we can do over the next 5 to 10 years.
So this is new clients, younger clients, or do you cannibalize your existing clients?
No, it's really a different business for us. If you think about Goldman Sachs over a long period of time, we had a very high-end wealth management business, but we really haven't dealt with the everyday consumer. And so this is a new business for us. When you look at the client list that we're attracting, there are people across all demographics, all ages. I think there's no question, I have kids who are in their 20s, and there's no question they're very attracted to the digital applications and the use of ease. They're not typically walking into a more traditional bank branch or using a more traditional offering. But there are people across the age spectrum that are intrigued by what we offer. We offer attractive deposit rates. We offer less friction, and we're trying to develop products that we think will make financial life easier for consumers with less friction and more transparency.
When will that be rolled out in Asia?
I can't predict when and if it will come to Asia. We're focused on building a really good business that's primarily based in the United States, and as we make progress, we'll think about whether or not it makes sense for us to expand in other places.
So you mentioned your partnership with Apple. A couple of weeks ago, it came under pressure because of an algorithm that was gender bias. First, when did you hear about the news, and what's the next step in how you can fix this?
Yeah, I'd start by saying that we're very excited about the launch of the credit card. This partnership with Apple has allowed us to offer a credit card that we think gives consumers more information, more flexibility, the ability to do more digitally. And the launch of it, by any standard, has been the most successful co-branded credit card launch to date. There is no gender bias in our process for extending credit. We don't ask whether, when someone applies, they're a man or a woman. We don't ask if they're married. And in addition, when we set up our credit processes, as is required under law in the United States, everyone brings in to all credit card platforms a third-party consultant to make sure there are no unintended biases in that process. You just used the word black box. Actually, when you look at our credit process, any individual that applies for the card, we can go look at the exact specific characteristics of why a credit decision's made and communicate with them about that credit decision. And so one of the things we're trying to do is increase the transparency, and we're going to continue to work at that.
So there was no bias?
There is no bias. There is no bias. Now, there's no question that different applicants can get different results, and that can be for a variety of reasons. But we're working, and we're going to be very focused on making sure people understand that when they apply individually for credit, there are a whole variety of factors that go into it. Gender is not one, but it's their individual credit. And we're going to work over time to do more to deliver transparency to our clients, because that's one of the things that we like about this credit card. How can you have more information? You go on, you apply, you're immediately told what your credit line is. If you don't like your credit line, you can call someone, talk to them, give them more information, and there can potentially be a change. So we're excited about that transparency, and we're committed to working with Apple to improve that transparency so that it's a unique and differentiated product.
How do you see Goldman Sachs in the next 5 years? Where are you, where are you putting your growth on? Where are you putting money in? And sure. Are there units that you're retrenching from?
Sure. We've talked a lot about this. We've talked a lot about the fact that we're trying to find opportunities to continue to grow our client franchise and our business. We're focused on obviously strengthening our core existing businesses that we've been in for a long time, our investment banking business, our sales and trading business.
Looking for places
where we can make investments. In any business, I think there are gaps where you're not performing where you'd like to, and I think the discipline of going and saying, what's our market share there? Can it be improved? How can we improve our position? We do that in all our businesses all the time. The significant things that we're doing is that we're focused on building a digital consumer platform in the U.S., as you and I talked about. We're focused on expanding our wealth management capabilities to a broader audience. We made an acquisition earlier this year that's helping us move in that direction. And in addition, we're adding certain products and services that can serve our existing clients.
That was David Solomon, the chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs Group.
Coming up, UBS CEO Sergio Ermotti. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on the crisis at South Africa's dominant electricity supplier, Eskom Holdings, with Bloomberg's Mike Cohen in Cape Town.
The situation.
It's a real crisis. The state-owned utility can't cover its costs and make the huge interest payments on its mountain of debt, which currently stands at about $30 billion. Its poorly maintained power plants also struggling to meet demand, and it's gone through 10 chief executive offices in a decade.
The background.
The company's debt metrics have deteriorated remarkably over the last couple of years, and now it's in a really dire financial situation and reliant on government bailouts to remain solvent.
The argument.
Well, I don't think it's going to be a quick process to fix it. The government has suggested that they're going to split Eskom into three operating units, generation, distribution, and transmission, which will make it easier to manage and make it easier for the units to raise debt. But that's going to take a number of months to organize.
For more on Eskom or other quick takes, go to Bloomberg.com, or for terminal customers, go to NIQuick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
Broadcasting live from the Interactive Broker Studio in New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter.
UBS boss Sergio Ermotti says his company is, quote, extremely well-positioned right now amid a number of looming risks, among them the situation in Hong Kong and the ongoing trade war.
Earlier, he told Bloomberg's Manus Cranny exclusively, the latest Hong Kong escalation is not constructive for discussions.
Of course, any escalations is not going to be something that is going to be constructive for all these discussions. But at the end of the day, it's between the politicians to sort out how they want to address those issues.
We've got together a couple of times this year, and I suppose these levels of protests have been going on for a number of weeks. Has any money flowed out? Has been any allocation of capital away from Hong Kong from any of the clients?
No, we haven't seen that yet. We saw clients and people, thinking about contingency planning. But to be honest, so far we haven't seen any outflows or major movements.
Each quarter, when we get together, we talk about the allocation to cash, and perhaps upping that allocation from the clients. As we look at 2020, I look at volatility across a whole series of metrics. Are we complacent about the risks going into 2020?
Well, I would argue that we have been complacent for a while in financial markets. If you look at the macroeconomic picture, if you look at the geopolitical picture in the last 2-3 years,
yeah,
it's been quite challenging. And despite that, you know, markets and financial assets have been reaching all-time highs. So I don't see a lot of changes in that environment. We have been complacent, markets have been complacent, but this is probably the outcome of low rates or negative rates. So in that sense, 2020 probably will be a little bit more of the same that we saw in the last few years. Of course, with all those issues being unresolved,
yeah,
the chances that one day or the other things are going to be out of sync is increasing.
We caught up over a year ago in September in London, and part of that discourse was about growth. And I said to you, look, the market doubts the growth story and what you're delivering. What's the one biggest thing that you've done, or a number of biggest things that you've done, that reconstitute the growth story for UBS?
Well, I think that we are positioned. If you look at UBS, we are centered towards our position as the leading wealth manager in the world, leading asset gatherer in the world, and wealth creation is a secular trend. People will, and the need of individual investors, but also institutional investors, to save money and invest money is a trend that plays very well to who we are. So we are extremely well positioned to capture growth in that sense.
Okay, so you've got all the chess pieces on the right position on the board. I suppose maybe the more exacting question is, are you the right scale? Do you think UBS is the right scale to take it forward?
Well, our position, look, we are the largest wealth manager in the world, not only because of the size of the clients' assets, 2.5 trillions of clients' assets, but also the fact that we are a leader in the U.S., we are one of the leader in the U.S., we are a leader in Asia and Europe and Switzerland. Therefore, we are well positioned to capture this growth. So scale is eventually going to be an issue for many players, no matter how big you are.
Does that mean that you're not going to need to do a deal? Because that's what I've come to you 3-4 times this year, and the rumors in the market are you're looking at this bank, you're looking at this asset manager. Are you going to need to do a deal to change the scale story?
We don't need to do a deal. It's exactly like saying you're never going to do a deal, or you need to do a deal. I mean, the truth of the matter is that nobody can really in any industry today say that you are ruling out doing a deal. But we are not forced to do deals. We have a good strategy. Has been quite successful for the last few years, and we are well positioned to capture organic opportunities.
That was UBS CEO Sergio Ermotti.
And coming up, Credit Suisse CEO Tidjian Thiam. This is Bloomberg.
With the Bloomberg Business of Sports Report, I'm Michael Barr. Nike's going all in on hands-free footwear. After announcing a self-lacing shoe in January, it's now investing in Hands-Free Labs, a company that essentially makes loafers that go on and off without a lot of fumbling. They're popular with those with disabilities who have trouble tying them or just don't like laces. Nike says the technology has the potential to remove barriers to playing sports. With the U.S. preparing to host the World Cup in 2026, one Major League Soccer owner is leading a $50 million investment in what he called the most important decade for the sport in the country. Richie Graham, a part owner of the Philadelphia Union, says American soccer has a voice, and that voice is getting louder. Graham says the investment fund would be focused on growing the game in North America. And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr, brought to you by the all-new gas-powered Sprinter from Mercedes-Benz.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, this is Bloomberg Best.
It's 47 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg Opinion. David Westin spoke with columnist Jonathan Bernstein about impeachment.
Bloomberg Opinion, informed perspectives, and expert data-driven commentary on breaking news.
From the Interactive Brokers studio, it's time now for Bloomberg Opinion. And we welcome today columnist Jonathan Bernstein. So, Jonathan, this is a twofer today. You've written both on the impeachment and the debate last night. Let's start with the impeachment. You've written several columns now on this subject. What are we learning, if anything?
Well, right now, it appears that the story that Democrats are presenting, of what Donald Trump did with regard to Ukraine, there doesn't seem to be any important factual disputes really at stake now. So it's really just a question of how members of Congress interpret it, and specifically whether Republicans are willing to sort of accept the facts that are being presented to their faces, or if they're going to ignore them and, you know, move on from and continue to sort of dismiss all of it.
So just today we heard from David Holmes before the House Intelligence Committee. He's political counsel at the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv over in Ukraine. And one of the things he pointed to was basically a fundamental shift in U.S. foreign policy. This is part of what he had to say.
The three priorities of security, economy, and justice, and our support for Ukrainian democratic resistance to Russian aggression, became overshadowed by a political agenda promoted by former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and a cadre of officials operating with a direct channel to the White House.
So, Jonathan, to play devil's advocate here, what's wrong with that? This goes back a little bit to Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, saying, get over it. There was an election and politics does enter into foreign policy. Why can't the president change our foreign policy toward Ukraine if he wants to?
The president certainly can change the policy. He has the authority to do that. What he doesn't have what he can't do is to change the policy for his personal political benefit. There's nothing, politics always enters into foreign policy, it always enters into all kinds of policy, but that's general sort of political health of the nation, political health, but you can't turn policy into a vendetta against your political rivals. That's way, way, way beyond the line, and that's what, by all accounts, that's what Donald Trump did here.
Which takes us to motivation, and we now have Ron Johnson, Senator Ron Johnson, coming out and saying, look, I've been talking to President Trump about this. He's had a problem with Ukraine. Yes, he's got real problems with Ukraine on the merits, as it were, and I've been trying to turn him around on this, and I think we finally got him to open up to it. It's a much more innocent explanation than just he wanted to do in a political rival, right?
Well, it's not really an innocent explanation. It doesn't really matter why he dislikes Ukraine. It matters what he specifically did. And what he specifically did was condition two important things that Ukraine wanted. That is the military aid and a White House meeting with the new president on specifically chasing down some, sort of ridiculous rumors about 2016 election and coming out against Joe Biden. So it doesn't really matter what he thought about Ukraine. It matters what he actually asked for, and what he actually asked for just isn't legitimate.
So the polls that I've seen at least indicate that Republicans are overwhelming in support of the president, saying he should not be removed from office. The Democrats are overwhelming the other direction. Independents are largely divided down the middle. You said we should focus on the approval ratings for the president. Is there any indication of the polling thus far that anybody's changing their mind?
Essentially zero. When the scandal first came out, he was around 42, maybe 43% approval rating, according to the polling averages. He's now right around, he dropped down to 41%, and he stayed right there throughout the last couple of weeks. No apparent change whatsoever.
That was Bloomberg Opinion columnist Jonathan Bernstein. You can read more on this and other stories from Bloomberg Opinion at Bloomberg.com/opinion and on the terminal by typing OPIN Go.
And now let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Ed Corey on WWJ in Detroit. I'm reporting Michigan-based Whirlpool is teaming up with home builder D.R. Horton to provide appliances to homeowners across the country.
I'm Courtney Donahoe on WHAS in Louisville. The average Thanksgiving dinner this year is up a penny to $48.91.
I'm Tom Busby, and on WBZ in Boston, I'll be reporting on General Electric's plans to begin training local workers for the manufacturing jobs of the future.
I'm Elisa Parenti. On 1010 Winds in New York, I'm reporting WeWork tells 2,400 employees they're now out of work.
Thanks, Elisa. Credit Suisse is working to expand its business in emerging markets.
and CEO Tijian Tiam spoke exclusively to Bloomberg at the New Economy Forum in Beijing with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix.
Do Chinese billionaires want to invest differently to other billionaires?
They have different needs. We help them grow their business, like this IPO we just did, but also we help them diversify. The problem of people who have been very successful in business is that generally all their wealth is in one company and it's quite illiquid. So what we help them do is monetize that wealth and then diversify and invest globally, which is a win-win. It's a win for them and it's a win for the destinations where their investments go.
When you look at your very wealthy clients in Asia, are they impacted by the U.S.-China trade war? Do they invest less? And is that the biggest problem for the economy in 2-3 years?
I think it has a number of impacts. One, it reduces the visibility. So it's more difficult to make long-term investment decisions because of that. On the negative side, on the positive side, it has led to a lot of restructuring of trade flows in Asia. If you look at countries like Vietnam or the Philippines, a lot of our clients have operations already in all those countries. So they can shift production and manufacturing from one country to another. And you've seen a lot of that. So you've seen a growth of kind of intra-China trade as a result of this. But what we all hope for is for a resolution.
But do the supply chains change? Mm. So if we have a resolution, maybe even more than something, you know, more than a phase one, let's say, do supply chains come back to China or they stay as they are?
I'm not sure. I worry that some of those changes will be irreversible, you know, because once you, this is why it's so important that this gets resolved, because in the end it affects trust. Trust and belief in the multilateral system, and this is something we all need for the economy, the global economy to grow.
Talking about trust, how do the Hong Kong protests impact your clients in Hong Kong?
So far we have not seen an impact. So far we have not seen an impact. I think people are taking a kind of wait and see attitude. And I think the central expectation that this somehow will get resolved. We have not seen big outflows or any significant movement from our clients.
So they're not trying to open offshore accounts or...
No.
If Hong Kong as a hub, a financial hub, is hurt, does it automatically go to Singapore or does it go somewhere else?
Well, what we hope is for a positive resolution. I'm not going to speculate on what would happen if things went wrong. We still hope that a positive resolution will be found so that this region of the world, which has been growing very positively, can continue.
I know every time I talk to you about consolidation, every time I also talk to you about negative rates.
Yes.
Is consolidation going to happen because of negative rates if we have a banking union? Or is consolidation just depending on appetite of chief executives?
No, I think everybody agrees that in theory, consolidation is desirable. It would be a good thing. The obstacles to consolidation have always been regulatory and also political nature. Because... For those who have done mergers, have done them domestically, when you do cross-border transactions, it's just very complicated to manage politically.
But we're talking about a banking union. If we get a banking union, will it spur chief executive to
it
do
should
cross-border?
It should be a positive factor if we get a banking union. It should be a positive factor for consolidation. But at the end of the day, what we need is growth. This is why a focus on emerging markets is very important. The strategy we're driving of focusing on those entrepreneurs in emerging markets who create wealth and growing there ultimately is the answer. Consolidation and cost cutting is necessary in Europe because we probably have too many banks. But long term, the future of European banks is to win outside Europe.
Are you hiring in emerging markets?
Yes, yes, we are. We are.
In all units?
Almost across the board. I mean, got lots of dynamism in Brazil, something we're very excited about. The Middle East also is a huge growth area for us. Southeast Asia is huge. China itself is huge. We're hiring everywhere. And I would surprise you also in Switzerland, because we do a lot of offshore business in Switzerland, which is also growing. The division I've called International Wealth Management that I've created is actually based in Switzerland and does a lot of its business in Switzerland, and we've hired more than 100 relationship managers there this year. So the growth is still there.
And for the UK, I know we're in China, but we still need to talk about the UK. We don't know what happens because there's an election December 12th, but are you... I imagine there's no plans of hiring at the moment.
We develop a little bit the wealth management in the UK. But again, it's the offshore activity. London has always been a base for ultra high net worth people in the world.
That was Credit Suisse CEO Tijian Tiam. And that's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best.
You can see all of our best work at NI Best Go on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Our show is produced by Caroline O'Brien. I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter. This is Bloomberg. Bloomberg.